Frost and tell him the antibiotics weren't working. There was a chance he would want to send her to the hospital. Perhaps she'd give it one more day. Claude arrived in a snouty, mean-looking car, with the letters SS overhanging the front grille. Impala, said the insignia on the blue scoop of its front fender. It was a 20-minute drive from Mellon, and unless Claude had been ready to key the ignition the moment his mother called, Edgar thought he'd driven very fast. Claude brought the car to a halt near the barn where Edgar stood waiting. "Your mom said there was a fight," Claude asked. The odor of beer and cigarettes clung to him like a halo. Edgar handed across the note he had written in advance. "Eppy is behind the barn. I can't get near her."
"Where's she hurt?"
He ran his finger along his eyebrow. Claude cupped his hands in front of his mouth and shivered and looked up at the night sky. His breath whitened in the air. He walked past Edgar and into the barn. In the medicine room, he rifled the cabinets. When he was finished, he turned back, empty-handed.
"Is there still Prestone in the milk house?"
he asked.
Edgar looked at him. "You know, starter fluid. We used it in the tractor last fall. It was almost a full can back then. Go see how much is left."
Edgar ran to the milk house and pulled the chain on the ceiling bulb. He surveyed the tangle of rakes, shovels, and hose tilting in the corner. Rototiller, lawnmower, chainsaw. He spotted a red and yellow aerosol near a row of oil cans on a shelf, grabbed it, and ducked out. Claude met him by the barn door with a collar and a training lead tucked under his arm, and a large plastic bag into which he was putting a rag from the medicine room, neatly folded into a square pad. Edgar handed over the Prestone.
"How much we got?"
Claude shook the can. He clamped the bag around his wrist and pressed the nozzle against the rag. The bag puffed out with a fog.
99% ether, he said.
He looked suddenly concerned.
"You aren't smoking, are you?"
Edgar shook his head before he understood Claude wasn't serious.
"Good thing, too," he said. "Otherwise there'd be a big flash, and you'd be able to tell all your friends about your Uncle Claude, the Human Torch."
When the hiss from the aerosol tapered off, Claude extracted his hand and held the bag up. The saturated rag slid greasily inside. He waved the arrangement under Edgar's nose. A sweet tang like sugar and gasoline swept through his sinuses. It made the hairs at the back of his neck crawl upright.
"At least it's cold tonight," Claude said, taking a cursory whiff of his own. "In the summer, this would already be half gone. You might want to keep upwind anyway. This isn't exactly airtight."
Then Edgar led Claude behind the barn, quarter lit at best by the occluded yardlight and the gooseneck lamp over the kennel doors. Eppy heard them coming and backed up defensively until she stood in front of an unused old doghouse near the silo. Drops of blood stained the snow around her.
"If we both come up, she'll run," Claude said.
He was carefully looking at a point on the ground a few feet in front of him.
"Go around the other side of the silo."
Edgar hesitated.
"Get going," Claude said, "before she decides to cut through that way."
Edgar turned and rounded the stony circumference, passing briefly back into the light before he reached the thick cement pier, a foot high and 3 feet wide, that connected the barn foundation to the silo. Through the gap he could see the doghouse and the kennel runs beyond, and the dogs standing in them, watching. Meltwater from the roof had rotted a line into a crystallized snowpack beneath the eaves. Eppy stood stock still, fixated on Claude. Edgar crouched on the cement pier, ready to intercept if she bolted his way. How it got started, even Claude didn't remember. There must have been some first time in the kennel, some formative moment when a pup had injured itself and backed into a corner, scared and defensive, and Claude had stepped past everyone to somehow enchant it,
which was the only word for what he could do. He knew instinctively how to approach, how to touch, how to confuse and distract, so that, fearful or not, the dog found itself acquiescing. Maybe that first time it happened when he was very young. In any case, it was something he'd known how to do all his life. In high school, Claude began working afternoons and weekends at Dr. Papineau's shop. At first it was odd jobs, clean-up, repair, filing, walking the convalescent dogs. He liked the antiseptic smell of the place and the rows of prescription drugs on the shelves, like bottles of magic. When animals needed their dressings changed, he helped with that, too, asking many questions, which flattered the veterinarian, and seldom forgetting the answers, which impressed him. In time, Claude persuaded Dr. Papineau to let him assist on minor surgeries. The veterinarian showed him how to administer intramuscular injections of sedative, as well as the older skill, waning even then in veterinary practice, of the ether drip. Occasionally, a dog came in wild with fright. Dr. Papineau had a noose pole for such situations, but people hated seeing it used, and Claude learned to work without it, crawling into the back of the truck or wherever the frantic dog hid and emerging with a docile animal and an empty syringe. He was bitten more than once, but they were fear bites, quick and shallow, and Claude had excellent reflexes. He became a masterful judge of how far a dog could be pushed, and eventually he craved the thrill of those moments more than anything. On Sunday afternoons, when the shop was closed, Claude cleaned up and administered medications by himself. He knew where to call Dr. Papineau in case of an emergency. And if on those Sundays a dog was boarded that Claude had taken a dislike to, when he was done with his work, he let it out to run the halls. Then he jimmied Dr. Papineau's desk for the key to the pharmacy room, prepared whichever method of sedation most interested him that day, and began to search. Once the dog was unconscious, he carried it to its pen and checked his watch. Both methods had their uses, he decided, but he was faster and more adept with the needle. Though not perfect, Dr. Papineau attributed the first dog's death to post-surgical trauma. The second dog, however, puzzled the veterinarian. He'd questioned Claude for a long time about the dog's condition that Sunday. The session had left Claude shaken, and after that, there were no more incidents at the shop. Late night, autumn 1947, Claude was leaning against the wall at the back of a long abandoned barn, watching the crowd, all men, disperse into the cool night. A few of the men led dogs, muzzled and close-leashed against their thighs. A few more stood cocooned in silence and disappointment. A man counted out money into another's hand. The roughshod plywood ring had been dismantled already, and under the light of two white gas lanterns, someone was pitching water across the boards to rinse the blood away. Outside, bitter laughter, black undercurrent of animosity. An argument followed, quickly shouted down. Then Gar appeared, shouldering his way inside. He blinked at the glare of the lanterns. He was about to leave when he spotted Claude and walked over, glowering. "Come on," he said. "We're leaving." "I got myself here. I can get myself home." "If you leave the house with me, you're damn well going to walk back in with me. The only thing I want to know right now is whether any of our dogs were here." "No." "Tell me, which dogs?" "I said no. Why do you think I'm here, anyway?" "I don't know why you're here. That's what we're going to talk about after we leave." Then a man trotted into the barn. "Hey, Doc," he called, waving Claude forward. Gar looked at Claude and then at the men cleaning the plywood. Claude had kicked the satchel behind him when his brother walked in, but Gar spotted it anyway. He picked it up. He looked at the initials embossed on the top. Then he opened it and looked inside. "You're kidding me," he said. "You patched them up afterward? Is that the idea?" The man called again, this time more urgently. Claude started to take the satchel, but Gar pushed him back against the beam. "Wait here," he said. He walked over to the man. Claude couldn't hear the conversation, but he saw Gar shaking his head. The man cradled his arm in front of him and pointed off somewhere. Gar shook his head again. Finally, he turned and motioned to Claude, and the three of them walked out of the barn, Claude carrying the satchel. Out on the road, motors started, and tires rolled over gravel, and the beams of headlights swung cross-eyed through the trees. Claude could see the bite punctures in the corded muscles of the man's forearm. A shaggy shepherd cross with a stocky build and a blunt muzzle was chained to a tree near the road. As they approached, the dog hobbled to its feet and began to bay, one bloody hind leg held off the ground.
"Knock it off!" the man shouted.
The dog licked its chops and limped forward. The owner sidled up to it, but the moment he tried to slip an arm under its flanks, the animal set his muzzle beside the man's ear. Even from where Claude stood, the baleful rumble in the dog's throat was unmistakable.
"See?" the man said, backing away. "He was okay when we first got out here. Now I can't get him in the truck."
Gar looked at Claude.
"You can tranquilize him?"
Claude nodded. Gar guided the man back a few paces. Claude set the satchel on the ground and opened the jawed top and pulled out a bottle and a syringe. He drew fluid into the syringe. Then he walked to a point just beyond the reach of the dog's chain and whistled a warbly double-tone twee, twee. The dog tipped its head, curious. Now in the dark behind the barn, Claude had turned sideways to Epi. He kept his gaze averted, elbows pressed to his sides, knees bent, trying to minimize his profile as he crabbed toward her with a slow side shuffle. He was mumbling a monotone stream of nonsense, the words an endless, senseless flow of noise.
"Say, honey," he said, "such a good girl. Goodness gracious, such a sweetie pie."
He held the plastic bag crumpled against his far hip, and something metallic glinted in his hand. He moved a foot closer, then paused, his delay just long enough that he seemed to be drifting pointlessly inward, every gesture slight and contained and almost accidental, so that he hardly seemed to be moving at all. Never a direct glance, never a raised voice, but closer, always closer, and always the steady, meaningless patter. Epi retreated toward the empty doghouse, looking wide-eyed across her flank. She knew she was trapped, and she turned to look at Edgar. He thought she might decide to come to him, but the howls and the flashing teeth and the desire to flee overwhelmed all else in her mind, and she froze. Edgar raised his hand to sign a down. She saw him and turned back to Claude and lowered her head miserably, mouth closed up, ears flattened. The gash on her face was black and wet, and she dragged a paw across the cut and sank to the cold snow and tucked her feet up tight beneath her. She sized up ways past Claude. When he was three small sidesteps away from her, she retreated into the doghouse, and shortly a low growl emanated from inside. Claude opened the plastic bag. Fumes wavered toward the ground. He pitched the soaked rag far back into the doghouse and quickly turned and sealed the door with his jacketed back.
"Wait," he said to Edgar.
He'd stopped the patter, and all was quiet. Inside the doghouse there was a panicky clumping as Epi positioned herself between the rags and the door. Claude sat looking downfield. A long time passed. Finally, he rose and stepped back.
"Come on, girl," he said. "Come on out."
Eppie's muzzle appeared. She blinked and stepped into the night. She tottered and growled uncertainly. Claude closed the distance between them in two quick steps and cuffed her under the chin with his left hand and stepped back. Her jaws snapped shut hollowly.
"None of that," he said.
In her confusion, compounded by the night's events and the ether fumes and now this lightning strike from Claude, Eppie let her top line soften and her tail uncurl. For a moment, all defiance left her, as if she were letting herself be taken down finally and forever in some fight that still carried on in her mind. Then Claude's arm was looped over her back, his hand against her belly. She flashed her muzzle back at him in surprise, but he already had the needle between her shoulder blades, talking again, low and quiet, and he stayed there even after he'd tossed the syringe away, stroking her and waiting.
"Okay, honey," he said. "Edgar, keep still. If you spook her, I'm the one she'll bite. Time to lie down and rest, sweetie. But a long night. Such a good girl."
He ran his hand down Eppie's back. She sagged and folded herself against the ground, and a shudder passed through her.
"Bring that lead over," Claude said. "Slow. Then put it on her."
"Okay," he said. "Let's find out what we got here."
Claude knelt and slipped one arm under Eppie's brisket and the other under her flanks, and she came up in his arms, the whites of her eyes showing and her body lax. They rounded the silo, and Claude waited under the metal-hooded floodlamp while Edgar fumbled with the door latch.
"There's a bag in the car," Claude said, walking into the kennel. "Front seat. Go get it."
Claude was in the medicine room when Edgar returned. Eppie lay stretched out on the examination table, limp but awake, keening feebly as Claude shaved the side of her face with the electric clippers. He stopped periodically to pour antiseptic over the pink skin he'd exposed, flushing loose hairs from her wound. Beneath the velvet fur, her skin was freckled. The brown liquid streamed down the fur of her neck and puddled on the table. Edgar set the weathered satchel he carried near the wall. The initials PP were embossed along its top, the curves and arches of the letters abraded over time into a pale felt. Claude laid the clippers aside and rummaged through the bag, producing black suture thread and a needle, both of which he doused with antiseptic. The wound was smaller than Edgar expected, opening just below Eppie's eye and ending near the corner of her mouth. Whenever Claude applied pressure, blood seeped from the ragged edges of the laceration, and the sight made yellow rings jitter at the edge of Edgar's vision.
"You made this happen," he thought. "Stop it. Pay attention."
He clenched his hands until they ached and watched. Twice Claude dropped the needle into Eppie's fur while placing stitches. He cursed under his breath and re-rinsed it with antiseptic.
"Is there another dog hurt?"
Edgar nodded.
"Look in that bag for a bottle of pills marked Valium."
The bag sat jawed open on the floor. Edgar pulled out bottles and examined them, then turned and held one out for Claude to see.
"That's the one. Give it two of those and wait for me."
Claude returned to his suturing. Edgar shook out the pills and walked to Finch's pen. The dog met him, hobbling gamely on three legs. By the time Claude carried Eppie out of the medicine room and settled her into her pen, with her head cushioned by a pair of towels, Finch had relaxed into sleep. The stitches in Eppie's face were neat and black and even. Edgar counted 12, top to bottom. Claude had smeared a glistening salve over the wound. Edgar dipped three fingers into the water dish and let the drops fall on Eppie's tongue and listened to the pop and hum of the clippers. By the time Claude carried Finch out, Eppie had come awake enough to lift her head and watch. She tried to climb to her feet, but Edgar ran his hand along her back and guided her down again.
Courtship.
In the house, Claude walked across the kitchen and knocked at the closed bedroom door, coat bunched in his hand. Edgar knelt and stroked Amandine's muzzle.
"What happened tonight?" he signed. "Why couldn't you stand?"
She dug her nose along his arms and legs, scenting him to divine what had happened after he left the house. Her eyes were bright. She searched his face. When he was satisfied she was okay, he stood and walked to the bedroom door, where Claude was still waiting.
"Trudy?"
Claude said, knocking a second time. The door swung back. Edgar's mother stood there holding the jamb for balance. Her hair was matted with sweat, her eyes set in hollowed circles above chalk-white cheekbones. Claude drew a quick breath at the sight of her.
"Christ, Trudy," he said. "You need a doctor."
She turned and sat on the bed. She looked past Claude as if his presence hadn't registered.
"Edgar," she said, "is Epi okay? What time is it?"
Before Edgar could sign an answer, Claude said, "She had a cut near her eye, but it wasn't deep. Finch is going to be limping for a few days, that's all. They looked worse than they actually were." Edgar's mother nodded.
"Thank you, Gar. You're right, I don't think these antibiotics are working," she said. "Could you drive me to see Dr. Frost?"
They stood in silence for a moment. At first, Trudy didn't recognize her mistake, but Claude's posture straightened as if he'd laid a hand on some low-voltage wire. Something like embarrassment and fear and another feeling he couldn't name made Edgar's face flush.
"Yes," Claude said. "I can do that."
Trudy passed her hand in front of her face as if clearing cobwebs.
"Claude, I mean," she said. "Claude. I'm going to lie back down. Wake me at 8, will you? Then I'll call and make an appointment."
"Not a chance," Claude said. "We're going now."
"But he won't even be in his office for another hour and a half."
"He will be after I call him," Claude said.
She insisted Edgar stay behind, that he not get near her. Reluctantly, he agreed to stay and watch Epi and Finch and Almandine. Claude backed his car up the driveway and headed toward town with Edgar's mother huddled against the passenger side door. Edgar dragged himself through morning chores, lining the pens with the straw bales he'd slept on before the fight. He checked on the pups in the whelping room and weighed them for the log sheets, and sat in the straw in the corner of their pen and dozed. The pups mustered the courage to mount an attack. He brushed them aside, but they charged again, biting his fingers and shoes and the belt loops on his jeans. And then he pushed himself up and went to Epi's pen. Later he would blame himself for not seeing what would happen, as if he could have prevented it. But during the weeks that followed, his preoccupation was above all with his mother's health and the mending of the injured dogs. He cleansed and salved Epi's sutures every morning and held warm compresses in place until they had cooled in his hands, leaving for school with his fingers stained brown from antiseptic. Her fur began to grow in, but she was distrustful and skittish. Finch's leg healed quickly. Most important of all, Amandine's spell in the kennel wasn't repeated. But lying in bed, Edgar would reenact the events of that night, changing the smallest action to stop everything from unraveling. "If I had let fewer dogs out, if I hadn't fallen asleep, if I had fed them right away." Sometimes he worked himself all the way back to, "If she hadn't gotten sick, if I could have made a sound, if he hadn't died." The future, when he thought about it at all, held little threat and little promise. When the Impala returned that afternoon and his mother emerged on steadier feet, new prescription in hand, he thought all their mistakes had finally been made. She needed to recover. His father had died in January. It was only the end of May. They needed to stick to the routine they'd established during the intervening months. In that way, their life would return to its original shape, like a spring stretched in bad times but contracting eventually into happiness. that the world could come permanently unsprung never occurred to him. And so for the longest time, he was oblivious to what was happening. For where his mother was concerned, some things seemed no more possible than if she might suddenly fly through the air. The pace of work hadn't slackened. The pups came first, then the food, the water, the cleaning, the meds. The rest of their time was devoted to training. While his mother was still recovering, Claude arrived in the morning, unloaded supplies, and helped with the chores. Edgar walked Finch up and down the aisle so he could judge the dog's recovery. Afterward, Claude stayed only long enough for a cup of coffee, drinking it standing up with his jacket on. Edgar's mother talked to Claude about what needed to be done in the kennel, as though they had come to some agreement about his helping out. Then he set his coffee down and walked to his car. After she was back on her feet, Claude stopped appearing in the mornings. Since he wasn't there when Edgar boarded the school bus, there was no reason to believe he'd been there at all, until one afternoon he came across a pile of white soap shavings on the porch steps. Claude came for dinner the next evening. The moment he entered, Edgar's mother's movements grew slower, more languid. And when the conversation turned to Eppy and Finch, Edgar understood that Claude had been out to the kennel many times since Edgar had last seen him, including that day. By then, nearly a month had passed. After dinner, Edgar went upstairs. He listened to their footsteps, their murmured talk not quite covered by the noise of the television. Her words filtered up to him, lying in his bed.
"Oh, Claude, what are we going to do?"
Her question ended with a sigh. Edgar rolled over and waited for sleep, listening and not listening. If she hadn't been gone that day, if I hadn't been in the Mao, if I'd been able to speak. Sometime in the night, the Impala started with a throaty rumble. In the morning, when Edgar stood beside his bed, fiery spikes radiated from the center of his chest. It was warm now, at least on some nights. One evening he walked out onto the porch and straddled an old kitchen chair to watch the sunset. Days of sunshine had melted the snow in the field, and a brief rain had rinsed everything clean. Almandine found a spot on the old rug and began chewing a bone, her mouth propped open against the hollow end. Shortly the kitchen door opened, and his mother's hands came to rest on his shoulders. They listened to the water drip from the trees.
"I like that sound," she said. "I used to sit here and listen to water run off the roof like that before you were born."
"I know," he sighed. "You're very old." He felt rather than heard her laugh. She dug her fingers lightly into his shoulders. "This is the time of year your father found that wolf pup. Do you remember us telling you about that?"
"Parts of it. See those aspens down there?"
She reached over his shoulder, and he closed an eye and sighted along her arm at a stand of trees occupying the lower corner of the field. "When he came up from the woods that day, those were only saplings. You could wrap your fingers around the trunks of most of them. They'd just begun to leaf out. I happened to be looking there when your father came through. It was the most amazing thing. He just shimmered into place, walking so slow and cautious. At first I thought he'd hurt himself. It made the hairs on the back of my neck stand up to see it."
"Because you thought he was hurt? Or because of how it looked?"
"Both, I suppose. I should have known he was carrying a pup right away. He was walking the same way he carried a newborn in the kennel. With his shoulders hunched.
Yes, but from a distance I didn't recognize it."
The sound of her voice was pleasant, and Edgar felt like listening. And he supposed she felt like talking. He had heard bits and pieces of the story as far back as he could remember, but now she told him about the miscarriages that preceded it, the final trip to the hospital, the figures in the rain. By the time she finished, the aspens at the back of the field had dissolved into the gloaming.
"Did you ever name the baby?"
"No," she said at length.
Suppose it had lived.
His mother took a deep breath.
I think I know what you're getting at, Edgar. Please don't ask me to compare different kinds of grief. What I'm trying to tell you is that after the miscarriage, I lost myself for a while. Time passed that I don't remember much about. I can't explain what it was like exactly, but I remember feeling angry that I'd never had a chance to know that baby before he died, not even for 1 minute. And I remember thinking I'd found a place where none of it had happened, where I could just rest and sleep.
He nodded. He recalled how waiting in the barn beside his father that day, something had blossomed before his eyes when he closed them, something dark and forever inward-turning. He recalled how after a time he had found himself walking along a road, how the one Edgar had stayed with his father and the other had kept walking, how all around the road was pitch dark and how rain was falling on him and gently drenching him. And he remembered thinking that as long as he stayed on the road, he was safe.
"Do you want to know why that hasn't happened to me now?" she said.
"Why?"
"Because I did have a chance to know your father. It's so unfair he died that I could scream, but I was lucky enough to know him for almost 20 years. That's not enough. I could never have known him enough, not if we both lived to be 100. But it is something, and that makes a difference to me."
She paused again.
"What happened to your father isn't your fault, Edgar."
"I know."
"No, Edgar, you don't know. Do you think I can't read you? You think I can't see? You think just because you don't make a sign for something, it isn't written all over your body? In how you stand and walk? Do you know you're hitting yourself in your sleep? Why are you doing that?"
It took a moment to sink in. When he stood, the chair clattered to the floor behind him.
"What do you mean?" "Unbutton your shirt."
He tried to walk away, but she laid a hand on his shoulder.
"Do it, Edgar, please."
He unfastened the line of buttons and let his shirt fall open. A bruise, mottled with sickly blue and green, covered the center of his chest. Somewhere, an icy tuning fork struck a bar of silver and rang and rang. He walked to the bathroom and stood before the mirror and pressed a fingertip into the bruise. An ache pulsed outward along his ribs. How long had he been waking with that feeling of an anvil having been dropped on his chest? A week? A month?
"What is that?" Trudy said when he walked into the kitchen. "God damn it, Edgar, what's going on with you? You're so closed up around your sadness you've left me here alone. You can't do that. You can't shut me out. As if you're the only one who lost someone."
She put her hands on his shoulders.
"In the morning when you walk into the kitchen, I'll see you out of the corner of my eye and think you're him."
"That's crazy. I don't look anything like him."
"Yes, you do, Edgar. You move like him. You walk like him. I've watched you in the whelping room, and you even carry the pups like him, just the way you described, with your shoulders hunched up, taking those careful steps. Do you realize that there are times when I need to leave the house, when it's just you and me, because I look at you and I feel like he isn't gone? I come back from the barn some nights and I can't help myself. I go up to your room to watch you. It's the only time you let me near. It's the only way I can get close to you or him. I'm not him. I'm not half who he was."
Then a rack of shivers ran through him. He pushed past Trudy onto the porch, buttoning his shirt. There was something else he'd wanted to say, but discovering the bruise on his chest had swept everything else from his mind.
"Edgar, I know what it's like to disappear into bad feelings. I know how tempting it is. You think by going further into it, you'll finally come out the other side and everything will be okay. But it doesn't work that way. You need to talk to me. I can't shake the feeling you haven't told me everything that happened." "I did. I told you. I came down from the mow and there he was. I had to wait for someone to show up."
The handset on the phone was shattered.
I got mad and hit it on the countertop. I told you that. What else, Edgar? What else happened? Nothing. Then what is that? She said, pointing at his chest. I don't know. I must have fallen against something. I just don't remember. Edgar, I've watched you do it in your sleep. You're hitting your chest. You're trying to sign something. What is it? He couldn't reply, paralyzed by the memory of throwing his fist against his body. Every time he thought of it, he almost shook with the blow. He stood on the porch, his ragged exhalation matching hers, until at last he remembered what he'd wanted to say. Claude isn't like him, either. Now it was his mother's turn to be silent. She looked past him into the field and sighed. After that last miscarriage, I wanted to have an operation to make it impossible for me to get pregnant. I liked that idea. That way I could be sure I'd never feel that bad ever again. But your father said I was only imagining the worst case. One more time, he said. Not because it won't be terrible if it happens again, but because it will be wonderful if it doesn't. And he was right, Edgar. The next time we had you. I can't imagine what our lives would have been like if your father hadn't believed so strongly in fresh starts. He turned and stared out into the night. Edgar, there's a difference between missing him and wanting nothing to change, she said. They aren't the same things at all. And we can't do anything about either one. Things always change. Things would be changing right now if your father were alive, Edgar. That's just life. You can fight it or you accept it. The only difference is if you accept it, you get to do other things. If you fight it, you're stuck in the same spot forever. Does that make sense? But aren't some changes worth fighting? You know that's true. So how do you know which is which? I don't know a way to tell for sure, she said. You ask, why am I really fighting this? If the answer is because I'm scared of what things will be like, then most times you're fighting for the wrong reason. And if that's not the answer? Then you dig in your heels and you fight and fight and fight. But you have to be absolutely sure you can handle a different kind of change, because in the end, things will change anyway, just not that way. In fact, if you get into a fight like that, it pretty much guarantees things are going to change. He nodded. He knew she was right, but he hated what she said. A person could stop a specific thing, but they couldn't stop change in general. Rivers can't run backward. Yet he felt there must be an alternative. Neither willfulness nor resignation. He couldn't put words to it. All he knew was, neither of them had changed their minds, and neither of them could find anything more to say. He stood there until his mother turned and went into the kitchen. Then he pushed open the porch door and walked to the barn. There was plenty of binder twine lying around the mow. With a little trial and error, he fashioned a double loop and a tail that he could knot around the bed frame. The thing was easily hidden beneath the blankets, and if she walked in at night, she wouldn't see it. He passed his wrists through the rabbit ears. All it took was a twist to keep them from slipping free while he slept. Late at night, the rotary dial on the telephone resonated through the walls. The rip of a digit rolled clockwise, the grind of the dial working backward, loud enough to wake him. Whatever part of her conversation wasn't captured by the handset rode on air currents through that old house, a gray smoke so fine it drifted up the stairs and through the furnace registers, and wherever it brushed a wall or a curtain or a light bulb, it crumbled into a dust that settled over everything. In the mornings, he tucked the twine into the toe of an old tennis shoe and looked at his chest in the mirror. It worked surprisingly well.
The first thunderstorm of spring came through in the middle of a night, lightning flashing through the sky and thunder rattling the glass in the windows. In the morning, the storm had lapsed into a ceaseless, undramatic rain. Slow, even sheets of water that paused for a minute or an hour, but soon enough returned, along with a splash of water running off the eaves. After 2 days, the basement began flooding. It was no surprise, and no emergency either. The legs of the tables had long been set in coffee cans. Edgar watched the water seep through the rocks Schultz had set in the basement walls. The float rose in the sump pit twice an hour, and the lights flickered as the motor engaged. Then a thump as the column of water hit the elbow in the vent pipe. Outside, the world became a riot of vegetable odors, boggy and florid. The waft of old hay, tamarack, algae, moss, sweet sap and rotted leaves, iron and copper and worms, a musky yawn that hung in the yard. For 2 nights in a row, the dogs woke him. They began leaving the run doors up at night, and the dogs slept with their muzzles propped across the wooden thresholds. From his bedroom window, he could make out their black noses and shining eyes. The first night he ignored their barks and rolled over and covered his head with his pillow. But the second night he detected a kind of fervor in their tone that drew him fully awake. He picked out the voices of Essay and Opal over the drumming of falling rain. He and Almandine knelt at the window. The dogs were standing wet in their runs, tails slashing happily behind them. Deer in the orchard, he thought, or a raccoon. He went to the spare bedroom where the window faced the orchard and the road. There was nothing to see. By the time he'd walked back to his room, the dogs were silent again. It occurred to him that the dogs might have seen Forte, and that idea cheered him. The stray seemed just contrary enough to come back after wintering with some adopted family. Edgar lay awake in his bed, hoping now the dogs would start up again, or that he would hear Forte's howl. With his attention so pitched, he began half-hearing a voice, the voice he'd heard in the barn when he'd slept there. The voice he'd heard, now he remembered, the night before, always intertwined with some other sound. He heard his name cried as the bedsprings creaked, a wordless call and a gust of wind against the windowpane. He sat up and pulled books off the shelves, running his eyes over the letters like so many scribbles, until the sky lightened outside his window. At breakfast, he waited for his mother to mention the barking. "Did the dogs wake you last night?" he asked finally. "No. Were they barking?" "A lot." "That's okay," she said. "They get restless with the thaw." By the time he'd finished evening chores that next day, he was so tired he staggered up the stairs and fell into bed. It was pitch dark when the sound of his name woke him. This time it had come through the splash of rain in the gutters. He sat up in bed, arms folded, listening. In a minute, the dogs began again. He slipped out of bed without turning on the light, raised the sash, and craned his head out. Everywhere, rain was falling. Directly below his window, Claude's Impala sat parked in the driveway. In each pen, a dog stood, baying. He slipped on his jeans and shirt and haphazardly tied his shoes. He crept down the stairs, hand on Almandine's back to slow her. His mother's bedroom was dark. The clock in the kitchen read 1:30. He knelt before Almandine. "You have to stay. I don't want you getting wet." He opened the porch door and leaned out. A breeze tousled his hair. There was no lightning, no thunder, just the steady whisper of warm rain, like the murmur of the creek, the sound that had once made Almandine pounce on the snow-covered creek as if something hid there. Silvery sheets of water poured into the gutters around their roof. Near the door was a light switch, When he flipped it, the goose-necked floodlamp over the barn doors came on, casting a cone of light across the rough planks of the double doors. He half expected to see a woodchuck or a fox scurrying off, but there was only the glint of rain dropping into the light. And yet the dogs kept barking with such a strange mixture of alarm and recognition, wet and shiny, as they looked into the yard. A flicker danced in the rain before them and was gone. Edgar was about to turn back inside when something caught his attention near the barn door. When he looked closer, there was just rain. Then abruptly the dogs fell silent. They braced themselves four-footed and shook off and one by one trotted to the portals at the back of their runs, where they pushed through the canvas flaps and disappeared. Whatever was making them bark, Edgar thought, had to be inside the kennel. He was never going to find out what it was standing on the porch. He turned to Almandine one last time and knelt to quiet her. Then he stepped into the rain and began to cross the yard. In the rain. He was drenched before he reached the corner of the house. The same rain, warm on his hand, now soaked through his shirt and jeans, chilling him, but it was pointless to go back for a coat. He walked to the Impala and pressed his hand against the hood. The engine was cold as a stone. He stepped onto the weed-covered hump in the center of the driveway, muddy streams on either side of him. In the pale glow of the yard light, the freshly greened grass looked greasy black. The two tall pines stood shivering like sentries, water cascading down branch by branch. But there were no deer, no streak of red that would be a fox, no shining eyes of a raccoon. He turned and walked to the deserted runs, wiping a streaming hand over his face. From one of the small doorways, a dog's head and shoulders emerged. Esse, watching him approach, half in and half out. When he squatted down and pushed his fingers through the wire mesh, she bucked along down the run, stepped into his shadow, and licked his fingers, blinking at the rain. Her posture conveyed curiosity without anxiety, anticipation but not fear. "What's going on out here?" he sighed. "Where would you go if I opened this door? What would you chase?" Esse waved her tail and met his gaze, as though turning the question back on him. He pulled himself upright along the timber of the door. The waterlogged wood of the frame creaked. He turned to look behind him to see what the dogs might have seen. The yard light, high atop the pole in the orchard, cast its globe of yellow. The earth mounded away from him, passing beneath the trees of the orchard and leveling near the road. The house sat at the edge of the light, bright along the driveway side, dim where it faced the garden. The shadows of the apple trees lay stretched across the grass. The forest across the road, an undulating scrim of gray. High in the air, raindrops descended into the light, curtained by the breeze into willow shapes that swayed across the yard and back into the night. When Edgar glanced back, Esse had retreated into the barn, and a line of glittering eyes watched him from the canvas flaps. He rounded the milk house and walked through the cone of light beneath the floodlight over the barn doors. When he reached the silo, he tried to look out over the field to the west, but his eyes were dazzled, and the dark began just a few yards beyond. He stared into the blackness toward the back runs and saw nothing, just the side of the silo sliding off into the dark and the silhouette of the broad roof. After a moment, he turned back to the barn. And for the second time that night, something moved in front of the double doors. It took a moment to make sense of it. A change in the falling of the rain. Something about the way it fell. He stepped forward to look more closely, traced a single drop of water as it passed into the light. Just above his head, the raindrop paused. wobbling in midair like a transparent pearl, and began to fall again. It splashed into the puddle at his feet. He wiped his face and looked up. Another raindrop had taken its place, and then that one fell, to be replaced by another and another. Nothing he could see held them in the air, yet each one hovered for a tick of time, then continued to the ground. He watched it happen a dozen times or more. Despite himself, he reached out to touch the spot, then hesitated at the last moment. He stepped back and saw the same thing was happening all up and down the space in front of him. Hundreds of raindrops, thousands, suspended for a heartbeat in the lamplight. He caught a glimpse of something, then lost it. He squeezed his eyes shut. It was like watching the orchard, trying to catch everything motionless for one instant. When he opened his eyes again, the way to see them all together had clicked into place. Instead of raindrops, he saw a man. His head, his torso, arms held away from his body, all formed by raindrops suspended and instantly replaced. Near the ground, the figure's legs frayed into tattered blue-gray sprays of water. When a gust of wind passed through the yard, the shape flickered, and the branches of the apple trees twisted behind it, refracted as through melted glass. Edgar shook his head and turned away. An endless cascade of raindrops struck his arms and neck and face. The same breeze that shimmered the figure caressed his skin, carrying a swampy, marshy smell. There was the scent of the kennel and of the water itself. Suddenly he needed to touch something, something too solid to exist in a dream. He stumbled to the barn. He ran his palm against the planks of siding. A wood sliver snagged his skin and slid into the flesh at the base of his thumb. The pain was brief and hot and unquestionably real. He glanced around. The figure in the rain had turned to watch. He attended once more to the barn, his examination now minute and frantic. He traced the rusted iron door hinge with his fingertips, and the jagged crevices between the boards where the shadows were as sharp as the line dividing the moon. He knew if he waited long enough, he would see crazy things, fantastic, inexplicable, dreamlike things. But everywhere he looked, he found the ordinary stuff of the world. Painted wood, pitted iron, water falling earthward from his face. Each droplet's path so foreshortened it seemed motionless and shrinking until it struck the ground. He shut his eyes and listened to his breath blowing. When he turned, rain fell evenly through the light. He was alone. He looked about, then spotted the figure standing near the corner of the milk house. Having once learned the trick, Edgar could not unsee him. The figure gestured. His legs blurred into skirts of rain, and then he disappeared from view. The dogs began to bark. Edgar found him standing in front of the pens. All the dogs were out, peering forward, unafraid, excited recognition in their voices. Their tails jerked back and forth, throwing sprays of water. The figure turned to him, and his arms moved in sign. Trails of water fell through the air. The distance and the figure's indistinct form made it difficult to read. Edgar stepped forward. The figure repeated the sign. "Release a dog." Edgar blinked in the rain. "Why? You think I'm not real? Open a pen." Edgar walked to S.A.'s pen. He flipped up the latch and linked his fingers through the wire mesh and pulled the door open. S.A. bounded out at once. She dropped her nose to the ground at the spot where the figure had stood and slid a paw along the grass. She looked at Edgar and then into the yard. Her tail swung happily behind her.
The figure gestured a recall, but Essay was already closing the distance at a trot. When she arrived, she circled several times, her shape contorting as she passed behind and finished on his left in a sit. The figure stepped forward, a water shimmer, and turned and signaled a down. Essay dropped onto the wet grass at once. The figure bent down and passed his hand across the side of her face. A stream of water coursed along her already soaked cheek, and she panted happily and pulled her lips back in a grin of pleasure and lapped at the figure's hand. Her tongue passed through a stream of water. She closed her mouth reflexively and swallowed and began to pant again. The figure looked back toward the barn and signaled a broad sit, and in unison all seven dogs behind Edgar sat. Then he signaled a release. One by one, they stood. They trotted back into the barn. A moment later, the canvas flaps parted and seven muzzles appeared.
"You see?"
At last, the figure signaled Essay to kennel. She trotted to her pen and disappeared into the barn. Before Edgar had latched the door behind her, she had joined the other dogs, looking out at them. He turned back to the rain.
"Edgar. What? What are you doing here? Don't you recognize me?"
"I don't want to say. I'm not sure. I might."
"How many times have we stood here and looked back at the house together? How many times have we counted the deer in the field from here? How many times did I lift you into the branches of those trees to pick an apple? Look at me, Edgar. What do you see?"
"I don't know."
"What do you see?"
"I know why you're here. I'm so sorry. I tried so hard."
"You think you might have saved me?"
"I couldn't think of what to do. I tried everything."
"I would have died anyway."
"No, I couldn't tell them. There could have been doctors."
"They would have done nothing."
"But I was there. I made it worse."
The rain figure bowed his head. A space of perhaps 3 feet separated them. After a moment, the figure looked up and stepped forward and began to raise his hands as if to embrace him. Edgar couldn't help himself. He stepped back. Instantly, a wave of remorse washed through him.
"I'm sorry," he sighed. "I didn't mean that."
"You didn't understand what you were seeing that day."
The figure turned and melted away toward the front of the barn, then rounded the corner of the old milk house. After a moment, Edgar followed. He stood before the barn doors. Under the floodlight, his sign was easy to read.
"Go inside. Now, before the rain stops."
"And do what?"
"Search."
"For what?"
"What he lost. What he thinks is lost forever."
Then the figure stepped away from the door. Edgar tipped the old iron bar away and turned the latch handle. Inside it was dark but dry, and the cessation of rain shocked him. He looked out the door, but it was only rain falling again. None of the dogs barked, though a few stood watching from their pens. He pushed the workshop door open and froze, unable to cross the threshold at first. He reached inside and flipped up the light switch and surveyed the room. Workbench to the left, the pegboard covered with tools mounted on the wall above it. Vise twisted open halfway. Except for the filing cabinets, they had barely touched any of it that winter, and a velvet hoar of straw dust lay over the bench. Across from him, the mow stairs led upward, and in front of them, shelves filled with cans of paint and creosote, their labels stained with drips and runners. He took a breath and stepped inside. He took the paint cans off the shelf and stacked them on the workbench.
Though the rest of the workshop was covered in dust, the paint cans weren't. Only a thin powder covered them, as though they had been recently moved. When he finished, only a pile of old brushes and rollers remained, stacked haphazardly at one end of the shelf, and these he put on the workbench too. Beneath the shelves, on the floor, sat the two enormous cans of scrap his father had been trying to move that day, brimming with bent nails, stripped screws, spare machine parts. The iron rusted to a dark brown, the steel parts dull gray. He crouched and tried to tip the nearest one out from the wall. After the third or fourth heave, the welded metal handle snapped off, and he tumbled backward. He returned to it on all fours, hugged it, and lunged. The bucket tottered and fell, and he quickly rolled it along, leaving a trail of orange scrap. He knelt and swabbed the scrap about. The second can had lost its handle long before. Another spray of scrap. In the process, something sharp had sliced the tip of his finger. Blood mixed with the rust on his hands and began to drip to the floor. He got down on his knees again, but it was hopeless, and he sat back. Under the Mao stairs, a jumble of dusty odds and ends lay tucked into the crevice where the stair stringers met the concrete floor. A paintbrush, long ago fallen from behind the shelf. A bunched-up rag. A tin of washers. He scuttled over. One by one, he tossed them into the workshop. A maroon drop of blood caught in the cobweb below the last tread and shivered blackly in the air. He reached out and brushed the cobweb away. There, against the wall, lay a plastic-barreled syringe. He picked it up and blew the dust away and held it to the light. The plunger had been plunged three-quarters of the way down. The black double gasket touched the final graduated mark on the barrel. The needle's shaft reflected the light in a long, clean line. He shook the thing. Two glassy crystals clicked within the barrel. He walked into the rain with the syringe in his hand, night blind from the barn lights. The rain had slackened to a drizzle, and at first he couldn't make out his father, and he looked around in a panic before realizing he stood exactly where Edgar had last seen him. The rain had grown so fine his form was barely discernible. Edgar held out the syringe. "This was under the stairs."
"Yes."
"What does it mean?"
"You've seen him use one."
"Claude?"
Edgar looked at the Impala sitting in the driveway, then the dark house. At his bedroom window, he thought he saw the shine of Almandine's eyes.
"He's proposed."
"She won't accept."
"She laughed at him. But she will. When she's alone, she'll accept."
"She won't. She..."
Before Edgar could protest again, his father set his hand flat against the center of Edgar's chest, a whispery splash on his skin. At first he thought his father only meant to lay his hand on him in a gesture that meant, "Be still and listen." But then he brought his other hand forward, and Edgar felt something pass into him. And his father made as if to cradle Edgar's heart. The sensation was so strange, Edgar thought his heart would stop. But his father only cupped the thing in his hands, as though it were a newborn pup. On his face, Edgar made out regret and anger and joy, and most of all, unutterable sorrow. Any thought to protest or resist left him. The world grayed. Then memories flooded into Edgar in a cascade, like the drops of rain passing through his father's figure. Images seen by a baby, a toddler, a young man, an adult. All his father's memories given to him at once. Standing over a crib, looking at a silent baby whose hands move over his chest. Trudy, a young woman, laughing. Almandine, a wet, blind pup.
vision of a young boy with a younger boy beside him, holding something in the air, something bloody, and smiling. 1,000 ruby-lit dogs. And with the images, a sense of responsibility, the need to put himself between Claude and the world. Dogs fighting, storms mounting the field, trees slipstreaming past the truck windows. Dogs, sleeping, running, sick, joyful, dying, always and everywhere, dogs. Then Claude, retreating from the workshop, searching the floor for something. Darkness. And now standing before him, a boy as clear as glass, his heart beating in 2 cupped hands. Edgar fell to his knees, gasping. He leaned forward, emptied his stomach into a pool of rainwater. From the corner of his eye, he saw the syringe lying in the mud, light glinting off the shaft of the needle. He looked up, panting. His father was still there. "Whatever he's wanted, he's taken, ever since he was a child."
"I'll tell the police."
"They won't believe you." Edgar began to sob.
"You're not real. You can't be real."
"Find..."
"What? Stop. I couldn't read that."
His father signed it again, fingerspelling the last word. "Find H-A-A."
He couldn't make it out. It was H-A-A and then something else, followed by a very distinct I. H-A-A something I. I still didn't...
The mist had lessened further, and his father was barely visible. His hands sprayed away on a gust of wind. Then he vanished entirely. Edgar thought he was gone forever, but when the wind died, he reappeared, kneeling now in front of him, his hands so faint Edgar could barely make out the motion. A touch of the thumb to the forehead. The eye hand held to his chest. "Remember me." And then his father reached forward a second time. He thought he would rather die himself than feel that sensation again. He scrabbled along the muddy ground until the barn was against his back and signed furiously into the night, arms crossed over his head. "Don't touch me! Don't touch me! Don't touch me!" After that, everything quieted to absolute silence. The mist grew so refined it made no noise as it came to earth, only the drip of water from the eaves. He could not bring himself to look up until it had stopped altogether. From behind a feathered break of clouds, the moon emerged, a gleaming sickle of bone as pointed as the syringe beside him. The trees at the edge of the forest glowed blue. He walked along the driveway and looked back at the barn. The dogs were at the front of their pens, holding sit-stays, coats like mercury. Their muzzles tracked him as he approached. They lowered their brows and ducked their heads.